How can we work through trauma? You know, I wanted to do things a little bit differently this week. I know that we're kind of in a very strange point in history, and no part of history is particularly normal. No part of history is ever normal. But it goes without say that our lives have been disrupted. And while sometimes people go to forms of entertainment to sort of unplug from that, I think it's also incredibly important to talk about our collective mental health and our collective well-being right now. And I know that I am not shy about any of my opinions, really, and I'm not shy about sharing how I feel in terms of politics. I'm not shy in terms of how I feel about social issues. But the thing that I'm the least shy about is talking about our collective health. And while the U.S. has a problem with collective physical health, for the past 6 months, we have been facing unprecedented declines in mental health. And we have seen unprecedented declines in how we treat each other, whether that be online or in person. There's a lot of ugliness out there right now. There's a lot of darkness out there right now. And I think about those things a lot, and I think about how do we solve those issues? How do we remember that all of us are in this together, even if I might not agree with a specific person, even if I might not agree with another person's perspective? And it's hard to just call things a perspective when it feels that someone's perspective is threatening to you. But I also want to be productive, and I want to make sure that I can add something into the dialogue that will help us collectively. So this week, I wanted to have on someone who I found online, and we're not going to talk about politics, and we're not going to talk about those dark things that are out there, but we're going to talk about trauma. Today, I have Sue Bowles. Sue is a master certified life coach and an author, a motivator. She's a great human being, and Sue's story is incredible. At moments, it's heartbreaking. At moments, it is very dark, but her story is raw and it is real. And on the surface level, you look at Sue as an older white woman, and you look at me as a younger Latino man, and you might think that we don't have anything in common. But what you'll find throughout this conversation is that both Sue and I have been through our own trauma. And both Sue and I are two people living in this moment. So through my conversation today with Sue, I think you're going to get a lot of how Sue worked through her trauma in her life, and how we can start to address the collective trauma that we are all facing today together. Because facing it together is going to be the most important thing that we can do. And I also want to make sure that I place a trigger warning here, because we mention things like suicide. We mention things around eating disorders. We mention a lot of things that can be dark. So if you are not ready to listen to this, As much as I appreciate your listens, as much as I appreciate your shares, as much as I appreciate your mentions on social media at Rich Sabata on Instagram and Twitter, by the way, I know that this isn't for everyone at this moment. I'm your host, Rich Sabata, and this is the Bodega Money Podcast.
Yo, smoking on top shelf Guido, and it's all over my hands like Cheetos. All she wanna do is dance in tight speedos, relax in a mansion like the Migos. I can't even sell the shit that I smoke. This shit cross bands like the Beatles. And we watch movies like it's Regal, then go cash out on seafood. Send her home with a quarter ounce of diesel. Girl, that boy don't even feed you. Yet he solidly spreading like the measles. I feel like these niggas want competition with me, and I only compete with myself. This for the niggas who stuck to the mission with me. I got Dev here up in the kitchen with me. Got the oven on 450.
Alright, welcome back to the show. You know, one of the things I've talked about with a lot of my guests and all of my guests since I started the podcast a couple of months ago is about the current situation that we are in sort of globally together. And no matter where you are in the world, I think it's pretty clear that the times are unprecedented, and there's a lot of sort of collective trauma happening right now. And my guest today actually specializes a lot in trauma and working through trauma. So with all further ado, I wanted to introduce a master certified life coach, an author, a motivator, and an incredibly strong individual who I've learned about recently. And I'm really, really happy and fortunate to have the pleasure to meet. Please welcome Sue Bowles. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, of course. So as I mentioned in my introduction, things are a bit crazy right now. And I think for all
just
of us,
just a little.
And no matter what really part of whatever political spectrum you're on, no matter, you know, where you lie on everything else in the world, no matter where you are, there's a lot happening and there's a lot sort of going on. There's a lot for us to process. Yeah. And before we get into how that can happen for a lot of folks, I wanted to know for Sue personally, how have you been the past number of months?
Wow. Thanks for asking. I've been challenged just like everybody else. I'm in recovery for an eating disorder. So when there's extra stress involved, my eating disorder behaviors can try to kick in. So I actually solicited some extra support from my counselor and from my dietitian just to get through those first few months. Amazing. Things have leveled off now since, definitely back to where I was, but you know, the stress was just crazy. I'm also an essential worker, so we had that going on. I'm a mom's caregiver, so we had all the everything that everybody was going through. We felt it just as much, with the added of trying to protect mom, make sure she doesn't catch the virus. So
absolutely.
But things are leveling out now, and it's been fun to utilize the opportunity to continue to grow myself. For example, as a master certified life coach. So just, you know, using the opportunities that I have. So it's been good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. You mentioned that you were recovering from an eating disorder. So I think I wanted to get a little bit into your history, because I think one of the things that became very apparent to me throughout our initial conversations, my initial research on you, is your very sort of extensive history. For the sake of the listeners, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your story, and I'd love for you to share your story with my audience. And particularly, I'd love to sort of start off with your childhood. So tell me a little bit about how it was for you growing up.
Sure. And let me make this trigger warning, if I could.
Of course.
Some of the things I'm about to share are pretty intense and can be pretty intense. And I just want to share with your listeners, if this is too much for you, if you find yourself being triggered by whatever I share, by all means, stop the recording, engage in some self-care. If you're interested, the recording will be here later. You can always look under the show notes and how to reach out to me. But take care of yourself first. So I want to put that out there first. And I appreciate the opportunity to share, because my story has become an opportunity to help others. I still get emotional about it. Yeah. I will not say forgive me for my tears.
Of course not.
I tell people, please understand. My story starts out when I was 7 years old, and I'm a childhood rape survivor. I was raped by a classmate after school one day. The kicker to it is that it was a 15-year secret, and I didn't tell anyone until my senior year of college.
Wow.
That alone is a lot for anyone to deal with. In addition to that, I was raised in an alcoholic home. So when the alcoholism is active, there's usually some emotional or mental abuse, and that was the case in our household. It is also incredibly important to me to say right now that my dad is 29 plus years sober. Every relationship has been restored and is stronger than ever before. And my dad is my biggest cheerleader.
Wow.
So no matter what happened then, it is not the situation now. It has bettered all of us. I've been suicidal twice. I asked a friend at one point in time, how do you go on living when all you want to do is die? I developed an eating disorder. That started in high school and really took root in college.
Yeah.
And I really didn't even own that until about 4 or 5 years ago, believe it or not, in terms of actually saying it was an eating disorder and getting the help I needed. Up to then, I called it anorexic tendencies, odd eating behaviors, those kind of things. But I never called it, owned it as an eating disorder with the severity that it carries. Fast forward to 2014, I got involved in a retreat program called Walking Stick Retreats.
Yeah.
And through that retreat program, experienced unconditional love for the first time in my life. Mm. I went to the very first retreat, very broken, really wondering if God and his kids could really love me, if I was lovable. I felt like I was too far gone. I called myself the holy exception, that everything was good for everybody else but me because I was too screwed up. Mm. And I do not believe that now. And it's just been a long, hard road of healing. There is no way around the healing mountain. You have to go through it. But I can tell you, there's an incredible joy on the other side.
Mm, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for sharing that with me and with my listeners. Mm-hmm. As you had mentioned, I think because your story has been synonymous with how you put yourself out there from a public persona perspective, mm-hmm. There is this sort of, you're reliving it sort of over and over and, mm-hmm. and you're leaning into it. So, I know it's, that part isn't necessarily always easy. So I'm incredibly grateful for you sharing that with me.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Second of all, I'm sitting here and, we basically just met, right?
Right.
We are two strangers, from completely different backgrounds. You grew up, was it in Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you grew up in Ohio. And I grew up here in New York City in the South Bronx. And on the surface, our backgrounds don't necessarily match up. I'm a Mexican and Dominican kid. And both of my parents immigrated to this country in the 80s. But I am finding myself resonating with so much of what you are saying. Hmm. Because I didn't go through the same specific traumas that you had went through, but I have been through my own trauma and, my family has been through their own trauma. And I think what I hope that, my listeners are able to get out of this conversation today is the understanding that we all go through incredibly traumatic things. And for everyone, the individual struggles are very much unique to them. And your hardest version of your struggle will always seem like the hardest thing ever. But there are other people out there who have also gone through tough things. And we can find commonalities and similarities no matter what they are. Similar to you, I also grew up in a home where alcoholism was very prevalent. I grew up in a home where domestic violence was very prevalent. I grew up in a poor, low-income neighborhood where I saw violence a lot. And there are things that, like, I'm sure I'll talk to my therapist about at some point, that I'm not necessarily ready to share with my global platform, but, those are things that, to me, I'm like, wow, you know, I got through those things. My mother, in her own sort of respect, went through various things. But I will say that the coming out of the other side, like you were mentioning, is sort of that joyous, oh my goodness, I made it, right? Like that overpowering, that weight off of your shoulders. And it's tough, right, Sue? Like it's incredibly tough to make it through all of that. So you mentioned a lot there, and you went through a lot. And I'd like to know a little bit about how you began to start working through some of that, right? Because at various points, you're going through a different sort of thing, and you're realizing a different sort of thing about yourself and your specific journey. So how are some of the ways that you began to start tackling some of those things?
Wow. And there's a thunderstorm outside. So if the connection gets a little unstable.
Yeah, no worries.
Wow. I think for me, it's important for me to say that I'm a Christian. So my faith in Christ is my bedrock of my life. Mm. And ultimately that became the anchor.
Yeah.
When I was on that I was on a ski trip in Colorado with a friend, with a bunch of friends from through a camp I worked at. And there was a musician friend of mine that was there. And Billy had lost his fiance in a car wreck. Billy was a Christian musician, and his fiance was on the way to surprise him. And she was killed on the way. He found that right before I went on stage. Wow. So he went neck deep into grief. We lost touch for a while, and we reconnected at that trip.
Yeah.
That was in the middle of my folks divorcing, and I was imploding. I was not taking care of myself. I was losing weight. I was starting to drink again. I was not doing well at all. And when I asked him that question, I said, you know, when I said, how do you go on living when all you want to do is die? Hmm. What I say now is there were only two things keeping me alive at that point. One was I was rational enough to realize my family didn't need to go to my funeral in the middle of the divorce. Hmm. But beyond that, there was a nagging optimism. There was something that would not let me go that was telling me it was going to be okay. And so that's where that flicker of hope.
Yeah.
And it was a flicker, but it's all hope only needs a flicker in the darkness, and it shines very bright. So that's where it started. It still took during that time. It still took in those 6 months for my heart to start to thaw.
Yeah.
But it really, for me, it really started. You know, when 2008, I lost a dear friend in 2005.
Yeah.
And 3 years later, I was grieving her like it was yesterday. Mm. My eating disorder was starting to kick up again. I'd gone through a period where everything seemed to be okay, and then my red flags started coming up.
Yeah.
So my pastor actually connected me with an eating disorder specialist, and that's where things really started for me. Mm. I'm still with her. I've been with her 12 plus years now.
Yeah.
I've gone places I never knew I needed to go. So, you know, you can understand that. But I think I ended up getting to the point that I wasn't willing to stay the way I was. Mm. And you know, they there's a quote, and I don't remember who said it, but you'll see it different places. It says, change happens when the pain to change is less than the pain to stay the same. Mm. I reached that point. I was not willing to stay where I was. Something had to break. Yeah. Either I was going to break, or how I was dealing with it was going to break and change. And thankfully, I'm here to say now that how I was dealing with it, it happened through being surrounded by a lot of people that cared. For a long time, I kept it all to myself. And the real release and the freedom started as I started feeling strong enough to just let one person in. Just one, not a whole bunch of stuff at that first. It's really honestly only been the last couple of years since my, you know, and I started writing the book and it came out that I've really been open about it. So surrounding yourself with people.
Yeah.
And, but the bottom line was I cared about myself to not stay the same anymore.
Yeah. I think that, one, I think that self-realization and that self-awareness that you were able to have even in some of your darkest times, right? And as you mentioned, it's a flicker. And it was a flicker at that point for you. Mm-hmm. But that self-realization is and was so critical when we're thinking about our most hopeless moments. And as we're thinking about working through whatever it is that we're working through, whether it be something incredibly traumatic or mm-hmm. it might be, a still hurtful and painful moment, but mm-hmm. something that is still bothering us on the inside. And I think that is the part for all of us, because I'll say that one of the stories I tell often, both on my podcast and when I go on other people's shows, for me, I used to use both food and alcohol as a mm-hmm. coping mechanism for the mm-hmm. struggles of my life. And one of the things, especially being a kid who grew up looking up to his father, that started realizing as I got older that my father, though he was my Superman, he was someone else's Lex Luthor. And that was something for me that was really interesting to learn to cope with. And mm-hmm. as I, the story I always tell is that I found myself in my apartment one night, and I had just eaten an entire pizza, and I had I was drinking two Bud Light Limeritas because I was broke and that's all I could afford. And I was telling myself, like, man, Rich, you don't want to do this anymore. And you don't want to. And I was saying that both about the current situation, about the pain, but also about life. And there was an interesting moment where I often tell my brother that he saved my life because he does not realize this, but my brother, when I was a little bit of a bigger boy, he would always make fun of me about the fact that I used to be a bigger boy. And mm-hmm. to me, he knew that making fun of me would be the thing that would eventually make me go on a health and fitness journey. And, you know, I'm grateful for that, because I think all of it kicked in together to work through that moment for me. And fitness for me ended up becoming the thing that helped me to work through my pain, and is still to this day, whenever I'm feeling incredibly down about something, is the thing that I turn to. So it's funny because they're psychologists somewhere probably know that, I'm just replacing the one coping mechanism with another, but I will argue that I think I have a little bit more of a level head about it today than I did 3 years ago when I was going on that part of my journey. Now, the thing I'll ask you is how can people find those sort of self-awareness moments and those self-awareness tidbits that we think are so important, right? And the people that you are working with, how do you talk to them so they can find that for themselves?
Wow, that's a great question. The phrase I use with my counselor, and I had to keep reminding myself of this at times, because there were times I wanted to bail. I was done, and yet I knew in the long run that, you know, I was going to end up where I was maybe 10 years later. And the phrase I used was, a manageable level of tolerable existence was no longer an option. And I think, you know, if you pick that apart, I think that can be where we find that motivation, where we find that self-awareness, you know, manageable level of tolerable existence. You know, it comes down to questions we ask ourselves and how honest we're going to be with ourselves. You know, if I were to ask myself, do I feel like I'm just existing and taking up space, or am I contributing? Do I believe I have something to offer, or am I not quite sure what I have to offer? Or do I think I have nothing to offer because I'm a waste of space and waste of time? Those questions can start the process, because that right there gives you your starting point. And then it's up to each person to decide, okay, so if this is where I am, where do I want to go? And am I willing to do whatever it takes to get there? Okay. Do I love myself enough to do whatever it takes to get there? Am I willing to believe what others are telling me that they see from the outside, even when I don't see it and certainly don't believe it to be true?
Yeah.
Am I willing to take that risk? Am I willing to trust somebody else? Because when we are imploding, yeah, we're trusting our own strength. We're trusting our own processes. We're yeah, trusting in our own thought patterns. And to kind of weave in a little bit of eating disorder thing.
Yeah.
When I was in college, activity became my number. Just like you were talking about how you replace it with one thing or the other.
Yeah.
All of us have coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
No coping mechanism is bad. It's the degree to which we use it and why we're using it that then can put a moral judgment on it and brings about different effects. Being involved on a college campus is not a bad thing. I was over-involved because, and I learned this about myself as I wrote my book. If I got my value from being seen, if someone saw me, they knew I existed and therefore I had value. So, I only put this together a few years ago.
Yeah.
But when I look back now, it became this. If I stayed busy, I didn't have to think. And if I didn't have to think, I didn't have to feel.
Yeah.
If I didn't have to feel, I didn't have to deal with my stuff.
Yeah.
So,
activity,
any kind of coping mechanism is not bad. And so to answer your question in a long-winded way, it comes down to some self-evaluation questions and how gut level honest are you willing to be?
Hmm. You have me here doing a lot of self-evaluation for myself because I was actually just having this conversation this past weekend with a friend of mine about how I'm always an incredibly busy person and I feel much more comfortable being busy than sitting still. And that's been the case my entire life, right? From college, where I was the overly involved student who was in like six different clubs.
And in charge of five of them?
Yeah, exactly. Was in student government, was on the radio in college. So from all of those things, and even now in my life now where I'm like, all right, I'm trying to balance being a good boyfriend to my girlfriend. I'm trying to be a good son. I'm trying to maintain my 9-to-6 job. I'm trying to maintain my websites, trying to maintain the podcast, and somehow squeeze in self-care is somewhere in the middle of all that. And I'm like, Rich, are you just filling your life in with things because you're trying not to think? So it's funny that you mentioned that because it's got me thinking. The other thing that you mentioned, I think, is something that I do want to make sure that I touch upon is there's a little bit of that asking yourself of those questions that is critically important. Now, because of the nature of the conversation that we're having, I think it's also important to know that there are some people out there that don't know the answer to that question, right? They don't know if the answer to, I'm not sure it's worth it. I'm not sure if the self-care is worth it. I don't know if I am a lost cause. And then you had mentioned that being a part of your story and part of your journey. So for the person who might not know the answer to that question, how can they seek the help, care, attention, love, whatever it might be that person needs in order to work through that, for them to be able to come out on the other side?
Right. It always comes down to it doesn't come down to one thing. It can be wrapped in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
When I was talking with my friend Billy,
yeah,
he shared how when he was going through his grief, a friend of his challenged him to watch his shoes. He watched his shoes in the airport, and he would take it. And every step he took, he was telling himself, one step closer. I'm one step closer. I can do this. Another step, another step. And when we were done talking, he looked at me and said, that's all I know to tell you, Sue, step by step. And that first step is to have the courage to reach out. because no, you know, you hear the phrase, no man is an island. Okay. Yeah. How do you reach out? Like I said, there's so many angles of that.
Of course.
One of the things my counselor, and we joke about it now, I've got a great relationship with her.
Yeah.
But when for years she would challenge me with things and I would just look at her and say, it's not worth it. Mm. And without fail, Rich, she would look at me and say, what you're really saying is you're not worth it. That hurt.
Yeah.
And it was so true. And to have, so when I say reach out, that reach out is coupled with courage and trust.
Yeah.
And risk. Because if you have the courage, if you're willing to take the risk and believe somebody else can see things from a different viewpoint, and you're willing to let that person speak into your life, it doesn't mean you're going to buy it right away. Mm. It doesn't mean you're going to agree.
Yeah.
But you're simply allowing for the possibility that somebody else has a different perspective that might not be as tainted as yours.
Mm.
Because when we are caught up in our own heads, when we're caught up in our own minds, when we're caught up in our own traumas, we cannot think straight. One of the things I've learned in eating disorder recovery is the amazing connection between clarity of thought and proper nutrition.
Yeah.
When I started with my dietitian, I had to relearn how to eat. And that sounds really crazy. Because up to then, you know, eating disorders, for example, are shrouded in secrecy and masks.
Yeah.
And my eating disorder happened because I got uncomfortable because I thought my mind was not well. And it was telling me that everybody was looking at me. I had a mask on, that Sue was the strong one, that Sue didn't have any needs, that Sue had it all together, and that she didn't need any help.
Yeah.
And inside I was dying. And how it played out was that in the dining hall at the college, I may want to go up and get some more food.
Yeah.
Being hungry is a human need that every mm-hmm. single person has. We have it the second we come out of our mother's womb.
Absolutely.
So there's really nothing wrong with that. But my brain was so warped out that I was telling me that if I went up, everybody was looking at me.
Yeah.
And that meant they knew that Sue had a need. And God forbid Sue have a need, because Sue has it all together and doesn't need anybody. So I learned to shut off my hunger. And then I would curb my hunger by snacking. So someone may say, hey, did you eat? Yeah, I ate. As long as they didn't ask what I ate, I wasn't lying, because it might have been a bag of chips to curb my hunger.
Right.
Now, if they asked what I ate, I might embellish it with I had a sandwich and some chips.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I say all that. Say, when I started working with my dietitian, I had to relearn to eat, and it's based off the diabetic exchange system where I have certain exchanges for carbs, fats, and proteins. You're probably familiar with this a little bit. And the first step was just learn how to eat in the morning, just eat breakfast. Over time, probably over the course of a few months, I remember one day I was in the kitchen fixing food and my brain just suddenly felt clearer. And I still remember it to this day. I was like, I could suddenly separate myself from my eating disorder.
Yeah.
And I told her about it, I told my counselor about it, and they just started smiling. They said, that's because you're getting proper nutrition. Mm. Because my brain was starved for what it really needed. And my body was starved. So it didn't know how to function correctly.
Yeah.
So when we are caught up in our trauma and everything that happens in the body genetics and the biochemistry of the body, and the DNA of it all, we cannot trust our brain to think clearly and tell us the truth. We have to have outside input.
Yeah.
And we only get that when we find somebody and we're willing to take the risk, have courage, and trust somebody else.
Mm. You shared a lot of really great stuff. I think one of the things that I try to make as clear as possible in my conversations around food and in my conversations around this health, fitness, nutrition, mental wellness industry is the relationship with food and how relationship with food, no matter whether you are Arnold Schwarzenegger or if you are Joe Schmo or Sally, you have to have an incredibly healthy relationship with food. And because addictive behaviors take many different sizes and shapes and forms, and there is one size fits all. Because I have trained with men who eat, you know, 18 eggs in a day because he thinks he needs that much protein in order to be the biggest, most jacked up version of himself. And he'll wash it down with a can of, you know, powdered protein. And it's a little bit of a hyperbole, right?
Yeah, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
So that's incredibly important, right? It's we have to think about all of those things and recognize that it might look a little bit different, right? Like that might not necessarily mean not eating food. It might mean eating very limited amounts of food. It might mean eating a lot of food. Mm-hmm. So it depends, right? It depends on who you are. And sometimes it's important to do that sort of self-check and sort of that self-evaluation. One of the things I talked about a couple episodes ago was a thing that exists a lot in the fitness space called macronutrient counting, and where people count the exact amount of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates that go into their body. And for me, I found myself right before COVID being incredibly obsessed with every single ounce of food that was going into my body. And making sure I could calculate every single little thing. And I would like make sure I'm reading every little label and I'm, you know, counting everything and measuring things. And I realized like, oh no, Rich, like that was a bit of an obsessive behavior that was not allowing you to enjoy your food as much as you can. And I think one of the benefits of me now living with my girlfriend is that that's no longer an option for me. One, because my girlfriend will call me out on it. But two, I'm the cook in the household. And so I am now cooking for her as well. And I don't want to force that kind of behavior on her. And I don't want her to feel pressured to eat a specific way for me. Because, you know, I have my own, you know, nutrition and fitness goals, but she has hers. And that's also important. I think the other incredibly important part that you mentioned and touched upon a little bit earlier was your faith. And I've gone on the record on multiple occasions that I am not a religious person, but I also can recognize the power that faith has for many, many people. I grew up Catholic.
So did I.
so for me, I understand the meaning and power of religion. How did your faith play a role in your journey? You'd mentioned that it was sort of the foundation and the bedrock for everything. But how did that start to sort of manifest itself as you were kind of moving along?
Wow, great question. And I have to say, I was raised Catholic. And there was a point in my life where I discovered the difference between religion and relationship. So I have a relationship with God, not just a religion. And for me, where that really came in, it was there and it's been there for a long time. But honestly, I have to come back to these retreats because that's where the healing started. And the reason being, I've been in churches that were very judgmental, that were legalistic, that, you know, and I think that's where I got a lot of my, and that's sad to say, but I think that's where I got a lot of the, I'm too screwed up for God. And I talked about earlier about having courage, taking a risk and trusting. I did that in 2014, 2013, 2014 was the first time I was dealing with the rape. And you know, when you, I talk about when I'm out speaking, I talk about how my emotions were, became frozen that day that Bobby raped me. And the longer you're in the freezer, the thicker the ice gets. So if you think about it, if I didn't deal with it, and that was in the early 70s, and it was 2014 until I really started dealing with it with my counselor, that's a hell of a lot of ice on the freezer. So And I started working with her in 2008, and we talked about how we had to get me stronger in the present before we could go back to the past. So anyway, with that, we were dealing with the rape, and eating disorders are about emotions not dealt with. They're usually based on some kind of trauma. Yeah. Her favorite question for the first however many years was, how did that make you feel? And I hated that question like crazy, because I didn't want to feel. That was the problem.
Right.
But that also ended up being the solution. And so I was imploding. I was dealing with this rape, and I was having to deal with it. I had to start owning my story, and I didn't like my story. I was in denial about my story because I felt ashamed. Everything that a current survivor goes through, the woulda, shoulda, coulda, blaming yourself, everything, I went through decades later with, after having all that ice on there. And one of the most powerful homework assignments my counselor gave me that year, and where I started to thaw, was 10 times a day, looking in the mirror, saying out loud to myself, the rape was not my fault. And it was not good enough to say it was not my fault. I had to name it. And I started to believe it after a few days. That started breaking the ice a little more. So by the time 2014 comes along, I've got all these emotions going on. And I was in a broken state. A movie came out called Ragamuffin. It was based on the life of a Christian musician named Rich Mullins. He was, his big song was Awesome God. A lot of people know that song. And it was a tough movie to watch for the first 20 minutes. Did a lot of silent, you know, got dust in my eyes then. And later that summer, the folks who made the movie and the family and friends of Rich decided to do a retreat to carry on the conversation about the themes of the movie, which had to do with reckless abandon, living a life of reckless faith, family relationships, you know, relationships with your parents, you know, all those kinds of things. Masks, the masks we wear. I was supposed to go to Nashville for a vacation. There was something drawing me to that retreat. It was like, it was that flicker of hope. And I fought it for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I finally canceled the vacation and signed up for the retreat. One of the staff members has since described it as a Hail Mary pass for me, that, that it was a Hail Mary pass that maybe God and his kids could actually love me. I had courage. I took a risk, and I trusted that others could see something that I was not seeing. Through the course of that retreat, 2014, I went in calling myself the holy exception. I left there saying and starting to believe for the first time in my life that Jesus Christ is absolutely crazy about me. And he not only loves me, but he likes me. And that, it, just all those things. And then these people, I call them my tribe. We have a Facebook group that we go into a couple weeks before retreat so we can get to know each other. And then we do life in that room the rest of the year. I have since gone back to this retreat every year. And every year I grow. So that that nagging optimism that I had when I talked to Billy was my faith in Christ. And that gave me that flicker of hope to keep trying and not kill myself. And then that same nagging optimism was still there and a little brighter than it was. To allow me to feel that draw and to take that risk. And it was the best risk I ever took in my life, because I wouldn't, I don't want to say that. I don't want to say I'd never be here, but I directly attribute my growth and healing to what happens at those retreats. And it is not the people. There's nothing magical about those retreats. I'll be the first one to say it, and they'll be the second ones. It's simply that an environment is created where the Holy Spirit can do his thing. They get out of the way. And it's just about love. There's no judgment there. There's simply acceptance and love. And that's what I was craving for. And that's where I first experienced that I was lovable just for me and not for what I did. And that's what started everything.
Wow. I'm sitting here and I'm like, there's a couple of main themes that, that I think I want to make sure that people get out of, of that. And the main one being, how important, any kind of community is. And your community, whatever that is for you, whether it be your religion, whether it be your faith, whether it be a community center.
The guys at the gym.
Exactly. That community is so pivotal and so important because they will support you and they love you. And that's the second theme here. It's love. Exactly. It's love for yourself and love, the love that others have for you that I think is so incredibly important. You know, I think that takes so many different shapes and so many different sort of forms, and it manifests itself in so many different ways for many people. I'm sitting here and I am not only grateful for the power of the internet, so we found each other. I am incredibly grateful that you are here to share this story.
Thanks.
Because Sue, you didn't realize this, but I needed this today.
Good.
I needed this conversation because you know what, like the things that I deal with now to this point, sometimes I get down on myself about career stuff. Sometimes I get down on myself about not making progress fast enough, about not hitting certain accolades, I get mad about politics, I get mad about being locked in my apartment. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, no, you can make it through all of this. And you have the power because you have people that love you, and you can you can do this because you have that power within yourself. How is it that I'll say that you work with people now in order for them to find that self-power? And for them to begin to tackle whatever it might be in their life, right? Whether it be the traumatic experience or it be something like like what I'm dealing with or what I deal with at the points where I'm like, well, I'm not in the industry I would love to be in the rest of my life, but it's a job and, you know, I'm frustrated with that.
So ask me that question again.
Yeah, absolutely. How is it that you work with people so you can help them find the power within themselves to work through whatever challenge they might be facing?
I think the biggest joy of my job as a life coach is I just get to ask a lot of questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the power is in the answer. The power is not in the question. The power is in the answer, because as we dig, as we talk, as we confront things, as things might get a little uncomfortable, that's where the growth happens.
Absolutely.
Because that's where the clients, you know, where the person's ready to go a little deeper and take off the mask. We all wear masks.
Yeah.
We all wear masks. We want someone to think we're somebody we're not. And some of that, you know, you have to play that game.
Absolutely.
But when we don't know how to take the mask off and be real, that's where the issue is. So the joy I get in helping people discover that, it's just asking a lot of questions that maybe they haven't thought about or haven't allowed anyone to ask before, or maybe have asked themselves but were afraid of the answer, and now they have someone willing to listen to that answer in a non-judgmental way. Because the joy of life coaching is watching clients realize that they can do what they thought they couldn't do. You know, I've got so many different, you know, examples in my mind of just little things. You know, I know of one person who is totally separate, but I'm just familiar with the story. Was just feeling so bogged down with things, and just broke up the struggle into very bite-sized pieces, and set a goal to just do one little thing, make it manageable, to at least feel like the first domino fell. And that just set them off where they just kept going and going and going.
Right.
They did it all.
Yeah.
They did it all. So I think, you know, how to help somebody in their journeys is just listening. We all want to be heard. And
that's key.
And seen and valued.
Absolutely.
And when people feel heard, they then feel valued. Hmm.
You know, Sue, I think one of the things that the current global situation is sort of having us face and reconcile is that, and this is something that I think not many people have realized yet, but maybe if you pause for a second, I feel like collectively our mental health has declined incredibly over the past 5 months or so. I look at my newsfeed, and the way I see some people talking about other people that also face their own struggles, about whatever side of the political spectrum you might be, the way we talk about each other, the way we think about the world, the way we think about the other, is something I see rapidly declining. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, where does this end? Where do we find that commonality? And I think that the hard thing, the really, really hard thing, is the uncertainty. And the uncertainty of where does the virus end? Where does the political tension end? Where does the social tension end? And not being able to tell when that ends or where it's going to end is the hard part for us collectively. So in this moment right now, how can we begin to work with each other to work through this collective trauma that we're all facing?
I think what you said, first of all, is first and foremost, we have to realize this is a trauma. And every single person in the world is going through it.
Yeah.
And a trauma is basically something, you know, that affects you deeply in some kind of unexpected, deep core way. Our sense of control has been taken from us by a virus we can't see.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. And the very core of human nature is, I want to be in control. How dare you tell me to do something? It's my life, not yours. Control. So that very nature of control has been stolen from us. So right there, there's stuff to deal with. There is a grieving that has to happen because of the things we have lost. We have all lost things. We've lost the sense of control. Yeah. We've lost maybe financial security.
Yeah.
We've lost our sense of self. And you know, we've lost contact and community. We've potentially lost our job. There's so many things. We've lost human lives. We lost a very dear family friend to COVID a week ago.
Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. This has been a little rough. You know, we've all lost things. So we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And give it its due process, which means feeling the emotions. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to be confused. Mm. The question becomes, how do we handle those? So when you take each one of those and you magnify it and work it through the grief process for every issue that has come up as a loss, it is no wonder mental health is such a struggle. The other aspect of it, and this is my theory, in addition to all that, we've also had to come to face to face with ourselves. I think there's a lot of people that don't like what they're seeing. Because if we're able to stay busy, if we're taking Johnny to practice and Susie to the game, and then we got to take Sally out to the mall, and then we're too busy to have dinner as a family, so we're going to run through a drive-through, and we've lost all, you know, we've had all that going on to keep up with the Joneses or whatever. And I'm not saying don't be involved in your kids' lives.
Right.
You're talking earlier about balance. But when we let ourselves, as you and I have talked about let ourselves be too busy, that we lose touch with ourselves, and suddenly all that is taken away like a huge knee jerk. I'm having to sit here and just look at myself and say, well, what do I do with my time? I'm sitting here staring at four walls and I don't know what to do. I haven't had this time. And then the irritability starts coming out and you're like, I don't like who I am. So you have all that compounding all the other losses added to just trying to figure out a way to pay the bills. There's such going stress going on that I don't think people have a full grasp on. And it comes out through the anger. And don't hear me wrong. There's a lot of righteous anger that needs to be out there. There is a lot of wrong in the world that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely.
Hear me very, very clearly. I'm not saying don't be angry. Handle it the right way. And I think when we use situations as an excuse to blow for other underlying situations that really aren't related to it, we magnify the problem, but we're not fixing it.
Yeah, I think the thing that I've been trying to do is remember that the other person on the other side of the keyboard, the other side of the country, that I might have nothing on the surface in common with, they are another living, breathing person with their own struggle, with their own hardship, with their own perspective. And one of the things that I've realized is perspective is so key. And perspective is what shapes our entire worldview. And someone listening out there might be like, yeah, duh, Rich. But I'll say that for many people, I am the first person of color that they had met.
Wow.
I am the first person of an immigrant family that they had met.
Wow.
I'm the first person who they have heard about who grew up on welfare and food stamps and now has a pretty decent job. And I think the noise that is out there is distracting us. And the anger out there is distracting us from remembering that there is no absolute one right perspective.
Right.
And oftentimes hearing things from a different perspective can either help you from a collective trauma perspective, but also the personal trauma perspective.
Right.
And that is so key. And that's what I think ties what you were alluding to before about needing that other perspective from someone else.
Right.
But also what helps with the larger situations that are happening out in the world right now. It's the finding the commonalities because, again, first time we've met and I'm sitting here and I'm like, no, I feel like I know Sue. I feel like I just want to, you know, walk down the street and, you know, just have a conversation. Yeah, exactly. but again, right, like, if we just focus on what's on the surface, we're never going to get to that.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure that we touched on that as well. For clients who want to work with you, Sue, how is it that they can reach out to you, work with you? Do you work with people digitally?
Yes. Okay. Actually, everything I do is online right now.
You know, for those folks, where is it that exactly they can reach out to you?
Sure. Best place is at my website, which is SueBowles.com. And you'll have it in the show notes. Make sure you spell it correctly. It's B-O-W-L-E-S. and you can reach out to me. I offer a 15-minute free consultation. Would love to talk with people, kind of make sure we're a good match, see if I can help you with your goals and how we can work together.
Yeah.
The other aspect as well is anytime I do a show or speak, I like to offer something.
Yeah, so absolutely.
If you go to SueBowles.com/podcast, there's a place, you know, just give me your email and then I will send you a sheet I have of just some different self-care ideas. Some of the things we've talked about now, some other things thrown in there as well. Just something to help you as you run towards yourself, to help yourself, help you find value and to know that you matter.
Absolutely. Well, Sue, first of all, thank you so much for being here, for being on my show and my platform, but for being here to share your story, and to share your story with others and helping other people work through the things that they are working through, because I think that the work that you do is so incredibly important and so incredibly valuable, right? And
you
know, I will say that many of us might not experience life in the way that you had experienced life, because our existences are unique to us and our experiences are unique to us. But what I hope people were able to get through our conversation today is the power in having faith in either your God, in yourself, in order to find the little glimpse and glimmers of light, even when you're...
Hope.
And the flicker of hope in a world that can be so incredibly dark.
Right.
So thank you so much for sharing that with me.
Thank you. If I can share as well, if people would like to learn more, you know, kind of more about the story and everything, my book is on Amazon and Kindle. It's called This Much I Know, The Space Between. And I should have had a cover here, Shoot, sorry. It's over in my bookcase. But the cover is a picture of a lighthouse.
Yeah,
breaking through a storm, and there's a very specific purpose for that. But you already know the allusion to it.
Yeah, of course.
It's on Kindle now. On my website, you got a link to it and everything too. But hopefully, if there's something that's resonated here, I invite you to read that. I think you can get some more stuff out of it, and I'd love to hear from you as well.
I'm adding that to my shopping cart right after we're done here. Well, thank you so much, Sue. You know, this has been absolutely fantastic. I wish we could cram more in this episode, but you're always welcome back to come back to the show and to share more of your perspective.
Would love to be back. Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, you take care.
Thank you. You too, Rich.
David James. Let's get it.
Hey, yo, Icon, what you got?
I'm back in rare form, nigga. I said I'm back in rare form, nigga. Yo, listen, I said I came from the bottom. You an elevator, baby. The struggle made us humble and genuinely crazy. Yo, silver spoon, never. I was raised in the living room. All day smoking haze, praying that I get it soon. I took a nigga pack when I was broke. Almost 20 with no money, up in college lacking hope. Had the whole dorm clicking. You know niggas gotta smoke. Wiping out the competition. Ain't no David had the dope. Couldn't walk in my butters. They only fit G's. Nigga, my wrist freeze. Niggas play Superman and get Chris Reeved, all from a text message. I have your girl on you. You be stretched out before you send your next message. I don't like niggas. Beat around the bush for what? I'm really nice, nigga. Ask around and look them up. I'm in a deli with a bottle trying to see what's goody. Yeti side, streets cold. You gon' need your
okay, money. None of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nice, say lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride. Said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nice, say lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga. I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby. I don't need a bride.
I feel like a precious pebble lodged under the sea. Since I was 8, I knew a 9-to-5 wasn't for me. Shit ain't always how you want it to be. That's why I gotta work hard. My ancestors had to run to be free. At 15, I was running the streets, drinking liquor, puffing the greets, cutting from school, fucking with freaks. By 21, I was sunk in the seat. G-Ride, bumping some beats, probably looking for something to eat. During my childhood, nothing was sweet. I wore ponies to school. The mother niggas had ups on their feet. It never fazed me though. I knew I was more intelligent, and the gift I had made it even more relevant. When I rap, I touch many like a known therapist, cause I'm packed with more passion than a gold medalist. I say something, they gon' jack it, nigga, no letterman. I can pop at any time, shit, there's no telling it.
Okay, none of y'all niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nice, say lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga, I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby, I don't need a bride. I said all my niggas gon' ride. Niggas say nice, say lied. Must be fried. Know where I'm going, nigga, I don't need a god. Married to this money, baby, I don't need a bride.